The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. I am your host, Bob Hayes. Today is Friday, the 7th of April, 2006, and this is show number 51. All right, this episode of MotoGPOD is sponsored by Komodo Gear. Komodo Motorcycle Gear is the result of the passion and combined efforts of motorcycle enthusiasts that have used their collective experience and applied it to their products. They race, they ride, and they cruise. They design their products with the safety, comfort, and style to meet the realities associated with motorcycling. All Komodo products come with a 100% satisfaction guarantee and a 5-year warranty against manufacturing defects. 5 years. For more information, call 888-KOMODO-G or visit KomodoGear.com. Komodo is the evolution in protective wear. And while we're talking about Komodo, I have not yet heard back from Rodney Mazion. I'm not even sure how to pronounce it. Rodney, if you're listening, you won the contest. You are the winner of our last contest. I've sent emails. I've announced it on the show more than once. Haven't heard from you. So if you're out there, you know, wake up. Email me at MotoGPOD@MotoGPOD.com. Come on, Rodney. Now I'm going to get email from like 3 different people saying that they're Rodney, but whatever. Rodney, send me an email. We need to hear from you. I'm not sure what we're going to do if we don't hear from Rodney. All right, enough of that stuff. This is our Qatar GP preview show. So we're going to have an audio lap of the Lusail circuit, talk a little bit about last year's race, and we're going to have some comments and thoughts about this year. Plus, then after following all that, we will also have a phone conversation with Mark Vandement from ProMoto about tire warmers and some more of the technology of tires, you know, the black gold of racing that they are. So it was actually a very interesting conversation. I was a little skeptical initially. It's like, oh yeah, tire warmers, you know, but Mark's very, very knowledgeable. And, you know, I threw him a bunch of questions, the best I could think up. And then Mark actually helped me out and we kind of came up with a few more, and I thought it was pretty interesting stuff, and I think you'll like it too. Now, before all that, I got caught out in a couple of mistakes on the last show. First off, which, you know, this is one of the hazards of doing it more ad libby and less scripted that we're facing here. But it's sort of working out in some ways. I got quite a few comments on it, which now I digress and get distracted. Another one of the hazards of doing it ad lib. But in any event, I was caught out in a couple of mistakes. An RGV 250 that I said was an Aprilia is not an Aprilia. The RGV 250 is a Suzuki. The Aprilia that I was thinking of is an RS 250, which is the same initials as the Honda RS 250, which is what threw me off and, you know, got my initials and stuff mixed up. Too many letters and numbers going on. So I screwed that one up. And then I also said that in the picks that were on, were they on Superbike Planet, I think. Yeah, there was a bunch of pics of Rossi, and I posted that link on the website, and people looked at it and everything. And it looked like when Rossi's crash in the first turn there at Jerez, that he was hit again, you know, when he was on the ground, after on the motorcycle, because, you know, he's on his hands and knees, and then you see this picture where he's, like, falling backwards, like he's going to land on his butt. And I speculated that he had been hit by Edwards. Saw some pictures from a different angle, had a few listeners email in photos and things, lots of good stuff. He was most definitely not hit by Edwards. And then it started looking, and when you see some of these pictures, well, you know, maybe it was Hoffman that hit him, but no, it wasn't even Hoffman. I think that he wasn't hit by anybody else at all, and he was just basically stumbled. In fact, he may have still been sort of moving along when he was on his hands and knees, because there's one picture that I've seen where there's almost like sparks coming off of some of his gear. So whatever, did not get hit. But still did a stupendous job of getting the motorcycle back out on the track, finishing the race. And on that, talking about the pictures, I found a whole bunch of really, really good ones at motorradrennen.com. And I'm going to post a link to that. It's a German site. The guy's got a whole bunch of great pictures. Now, these were originally, I was sent a link to a bunch of photos that are on apriliaforum.com by Mark Vandement. But the pics originally came from motorradrennen.com, so I'm going to post the link to that, motorradrennen.com, and it's motorcycle racing in German, and we will like I said, post that link on the MotoGPOD website so you can take a look at that. Just go to the link and then you click on 2006 and then crash and then page 3. It's a little bit buried, but it's there and they're well worth looking at them. There's a whole bunch of them, nice high resolution pics. All right, one more thing. We're now searchable on a service called podzinger.com. I had an email sent in, said, why aren't you on Podzinger? And I said, I don't know what the heck Podzinger is. So I went ahead and applied for it. And basically, it's a sort of a service where they index the audio and make it searchable. So you type in text and get the, you know, the text going on from the audio. And I can't find the email here, so whatever. Podzinger.com. There will be a link on the website to that, and take a look at it. And then I also said, yep, one more mistake. Going down my notes here that aren't very well prepared, apparently. I said that the auction at racingtosavelives.org does not require you to be there, that it's a silent auction over the internet. I was wrong about that one, too. So we have three mistakes in one show. That's not good. Racingtosavelives.org, that auction, you do have to be there at the event, and it's a silent auction for all kinds of great gear. They also had their auctions of the laps with Ben and Eric Bostrom, and the results were not up when I last checked, so we are unable, unfortunately, to tell you a lot in this show about who's going to be riding out there with Ben and Eric Bostrom, but that's taking place the 13th through the 16th, so next week. So next Friday, hopefully I'll have a little bit more news about exactly what's going on with that. Then one more little newsworthy item that's not really motorcycle, well, it is kind of MotoGP related, but it's not the same as MotoGP, is that Chris Johnham, editor of Road Racer X magazine, a very good magazine about, oddly enough, road racing, is doing not quite a podcast. It's an audio show. I don't think you can officially call it a podcast because I haven't been found a way to be able to subscribe to it. But you go to the RedBullUSGrandPrix.com website, which is the official website for the Red Bull US Grand Prix. And unfortunately, the site is just laden with Flash, which to me is the, you know, the bane of the internet. Can't stand Flash. And it even requires Flash 8, so you have to install a new version of Flash if you, you know, the newest bleeding edge version of Flash. But whatever, it works pretty well. Once you get it all installed, it's nice and fast. Didn't seem to be too much of a CPU hog. And you find these things called weekly dispatches. And there was the first one up. The second one should be up by about the time that you hear this episode, maybe give or take a day or so. But in the first episode, Chris Johnham interviews both Nikki Hayden and John Hopkins for a podcast. So he's killing me as far as the interviews are concerned. You should listen to it. It was pretty good. It was pretty entertaining. And we'll listen to the second one and see how that one sounds too. And it's going to be coming out every couple of weeks throughout the season. I think there's going to be 17 episodes all season long. So give that a listen. And now, why don't we get on with the rest of the stuff? Interesting article came out on Superbike Planet this past week where they were talking about Danny Pedrosa and his weight advantage over his teammates and how and fellow Honda riders. And everybody else, actually. And how he pretty much came past Marco Melandri and Nikki Hayden and passed them without a, you know, what a huge amount of effort, which I don't know if that was entirely true. And talking about his weight advantage. And Pedrosa comes in at 104 pounds. That's 47.3 kilos. He's 5'4" or 157.5 centimeters. So he's quite small. But that 104 pounds is the key because at 5 foot... Or excuse me, actually, he's 5'2". Maybe I should get that right now. And at 5'2", he's the shortest that I have any measurements for. But he's not a whole lot shorter than, say, Caparossi. But Caparossi weighs 130 pounds or 59.1 kilos. So Pedrosa has quite an advantage on the guys like Caparossi and everything. You're talking 26 pounds weight difference. And compared to Nikki Hayden and Sete Gibernau, Pedrosa has an almost 50-pound weight advantage. He's 46 pounds lighter than Nikki Hayden. Nikki Hayden is 5'8", weighs 150 pounds. That is, in centimeters, he's 172.7 and 68.2 kilos. So you can see there's an almost 21 kilo weight difference there between Hayden and Pedrosa. Rossi, interestingly enough, is the tallest of the rider that they had listed at 5'11". The heights and stuff seem to have dropped off of MotoGP.com. They list their weights, but they don't list their heights, and I've been looking for that and never did find it. But luckily Superbike Planet published it for us, which was kind of nice. And it's interesting to see that Rossi is 5'11", because when you see him on the rostrum and stuff, which you see him a lot, he doesn't look like he's that much taller than most of the other riders. You know, he looks taller, but not that much taller, but, compared to most of the other riders on the MotoGP grid, 5'11" or 180.3 centimeters is a veritable giant. He's towering over, most of his competitors. Let's see, what are the other heights we got here? We got Pedrosa at 5'2", 157.5 centimeters. Elias at 5'4", 162.6 centimeters. Melantri at 5'6", 167.6 centimeters. Stoner, 5'7", 170.2 centimeters. Caparossi, 5'4", at 162.6 centimeters. And then Rossi, like I said, 5'11", 180.3 centimeters. Very tall, comparatively. Hayden, 5'8". Or 172.7 centimeters, and Gibernau 5'9", or 175.3 centimeters. And then their weights are all in there listed as well. And like I say, they range from 104 pounds for Pedrosa, 154 pounds for Gibernau. So you're looking at a significant weight difference. When you're talking about a motorcycle that weighs 148 kilograms, that is, a 20 kilogram weight difference of the rider is a significant advantage. That's a lot. You know, you're talking 1/7 of the bike weight, in saving in rider weight. And the MotoGP class is not like the 125s, where both bike and rider are weighed to make the minimum weight. And if the riders are super light, you know, then weight is added. So the entire motorcycle will weigh a certain amount with its rider. It's only in the 125cc class, which is, you know, it's rightly regarded as sort of a starting class, and there's even an age limit. I believe it's 26 years old that the riders must not be older than 26. 250cc's and MotoGP is weighed where the bike alone is weighed. You're taking the weight of the motorcycle after the race, and that's it has to meet the minimum weights. So the rider, you know, a heavier rider gets a penalty built into that because basically he's just heavier than his competitors. And it's, you know, most sports are that way where weight comes into factor. Look at jockeys and horse racing and all that sort of thing. So it's nothing unusual, and I'm not saying it's somehow unfair, which actually was said about Pedrosa a couple of years ago in the 250cc class, that it's not fair that he's so much lighter. And that's just a bunch of whining, because Pedrosa also has a disadvantage with that lightweight because he doesn't have the same upper body strength. And we've seen that at Jerez, and we may very well see it again at Qatar. So we're just going to have to find out which is more of an advantage, that upper body strength to wrestle that motorcycle around, or the lightweight so that you can, save weight. And just kind of interesting. I thought it was a cool article. I'll put a link to it on the MotoGPOD.com website, and you can take a look at it for yourself. Let's talk a little bit about what happened last year, 2005, at the Qatar race. It was held much later in the year than it is this year. It was in October last year, and they moved it back all the way to April because of the temperatures as much as anything. So although it was on the 1st of October last year, we're going to have it here in April on the, 8th of April. Saturday race, unusual, just like Assen. Otherwise, MotoGP races are always on Sunday, but Qatar's on Saturday. So last year, quite an exciting race. Actually, let's go all the way back to 2004. We're going to get back into the Wayback Machine. Woo! And 2004, we had the whole sweeping incident with Valentino Rossi, if you remember. There were two teams that went out there, and it was Valentino Rossi, and I believe it was Biaggi. Yes, Biaggi was the other rider, and their team members were, you know, caught or accused or whatever you want to call it, of cleaning off the grid spots that the riders, you know, had qualified on, and they were sweeping the grid and cleaning it off. And actually, I think one team was doing burnouts with a scooter, you know, something. They were trying to clean off the spot so the rider could get a better start. And teams made complaints. Telefonica Movistar, actually, I believe, truly lodged the complaint about it. And race direction ended up putting Rossi and Biaggi to the back of the grid. And in that 2004 race, that was when then Rossi ended up crashing out. And that was where Rossi sort of put his curse on Sete, that, you know, Sete Gibernau would never win another race. And strangely enough, Sete hasn't. So you never know. He is the witch doctor. But last year, 2005, we had that whole drama behind us of the 2004 series. We were coming in, season was starting to wind down. You know, it was in the bag for Rossi pretty well, but It was still, you know, it was a good season going along. And everybody's kind of wondering what's going to happen at Qatar. It was a really good race. That's what happened. Caparossi got the whole shot. He was on pole and came out of there. Hayden got a fantastic start from eighth on the grid. Looked like he might get second spot into the first corner, in fact, when Sete Gibernau bumped into him slightly and bumped him offline and caused Nicky to drop back to fourth behind Rossi, which later caused Nicky in the post-race interview to say, "My buddy Sete," which I thought was pretty funny. So we had Caparossi, Gibernau, Rossi, Hayden, and Melandri all there. And Robbie Rolfo was up all the in eighth place right through that first lap on that Dantin Ducati, which was amazing to have such a good performance on the Dantin Ducati. But it wasn't last very long. Those top six riders immediately started checking out from the rest of the field. But Caparossi couldn't maintain the pace that he had to keep that lead. So he started dropping back, but he was still kind of hanging with the top six. Then Sete had the lead for a while. Rossi and Hayden were kind of jockeying back and forth a little bit. There's not a whole lot of passing opportunities at this track. You've got turn 1 and 16 where you really have passing opportunities. And then the rest of the time, you know, it's kind of iffy. But it's a very technical track. So even though it's wide, you do end up with one fairly narrow line because of all of dust. And that makes it difficult to pass because they don't want to go off the clean line. But the riders always try to make the best of it, you know, late braking like crazy, especially going into turn 1. You could see huge, huge differences in how late these guys could leave it to brake, particularly Rossi, as usual. It was very late on the brakes every time you saw him. So then on the fifth lap, Melandri started moving up. He passed Edwards and Hayden, and he's in the third. Caparossi started dropping back a little bit. Then on lap 7, Caparossi actually went wide, took a little trip through the gravel, but he stayed on the motorcycle and ended up back in the pack around 12th position or so. Edwards was behind the lead four riders, and Melandri and Rossi were busy working for second place. Hayden was a tad behind in fourth, and they're all still chasing Gibernau. This is roughly, you know, halfway through the race or so. Biaggi retired from this race, and so did Tomata. Two Hondas going out in the race, which was unusual. And then Hopkins also pitted for a new tire on lap 8. So just to go back, sorry, jumping around a little bit. But back to midway through the race, we had Gibernau in the lead, and Melandri and Rossi busy working for second place, and Hayden was tad behind them in fourth. So then Rossi and Melandri had closed the gap to Sete, and then eventually Melandri was in second place and trying to pass Gibernau. So these guys were teammates last year, remember? So then on the 18th lap, Melandri made a pass on Sete to get into first, and Gibernau went a little wide. And when Gibernau came back in on that corner, he damn near hit Melandri, and while avoiding the whole collision thing, he went off track and was just going straight out of the gravel, dropped down to fifth place, so that left Melandri, Rossi, and Hayden in the lead group. Now, Tomata also crashed on that lap, which, like I said earlier, that's why he was out of that race there. Actually, he didn't crash. The bike just stopped. But Rossi took back the lead spot with two laps to go. He passed Melandri. Melandri was right on him. You know he's going to try and make a move. He had gone a little tiny bit wide, and Rossi just took advantage of it. I just watched this race again last week. It was a good one. And he tried really hard, Melandri did, at turn 1 going into the final lap to try to get that pass on Rossi. But Rossi was just later on the brakes, and he kind of held him off. And then Melandri tried to sort of a Hail Mary maneuver in the very final sector of the thing, but he went wide. He was lucky not to slip down to third place, in fact, and he pretty much admitted as much in the post-race interview. But, you know, he knew he could not just take second place without at least trying to pass Rossi. So the final result last year, 2005 Qatar, ended up with Rossi winning it, Melandri in second, and Hayden in third. It was a good race. It's well worth watching again if you get a chance on MotoGP.com, or maybe you've got it recorded on DVD or whatever of your own personal stuff. Break that one out and watch it again. Let's talk a little bit about the Qatar circuit and what we're looking at. It's a new circuit, only opened in 2004. It was built very, very quickly in a year. It's considerable cost and expense. They fast-tracked it. They basically using MotoGP racing to sort of pump up the advertising for the entire country. They're not really concerned about attendance and everything, which is just as well because attendance is very, very low for the races they're considering. And it's, you know, supposedly it's a great place to go to a race. And Liam Schubert, our friend in Spain, is going to be there. He's actually there this weekend, so I'm really hoping we can work out a call with him next weekend and find out how things are going. He's been going there a few times working at the Losai National Cup. He was there over the World Superbike weekend, which we had a few weeks ago, and he happens to be there at the same time as the MotoGP guys, so it's going to be kind of cool. We'll have to definitely want to talk to him. And he's been hanging out again on the RideOn2.com forums and, of course, the Barf forum. He's got a giant thread going on the Bay Area Riders forum. So you can find Liam around on the internet and ask him questions or chat with him or whatever. He's an interesting guy. So we're getting distracted from our Qatar stuff. But the circuit itself, it's a long one. It's 5.4 kilometers, which is about 3.34 miles long. Fairly good-sized circuit. Very technical. It's got that long front straight. Other than that, not a lot of straightaways going on. A few short sections here and there, but no real back straight. It's a long front straight followed by a whole bunch of turns. And the circuit, even though the track is very wide, you get so much sand and everything blown onto it from the fact that the track is in Qatar, that it really makes for one real racing line over the entire track. So passing opportunities are somewhat limited. That turn one at the end of the straightaway and turn 16 coming back onto the straightaway are typically the main passing opportunities, but the riders try to pass wherever they can. They're going to make the best of it. Now, one of the problems that you're going to have in Qatar is temperature. Last year, the race, like I said earlier, the race was in October, October 1st it was. This year, they moved it all the way back to April to try to beat those temperatures because it's just ridiculous last year. Last year, we saw a temperature on race day of 39 degrees Celsius, which is 102 Fahrenheit. And, the ground temperature, the track would have been much, much hotter than that, probably 120, 130 degrees Fahrenheit easily. This year, in the free practice 1 and 2 sessions that took place on Thursday, official temperature was 27 degrees Celsius or 80 degrees. So it's a lot more manageable, a lot more pleasant weather. You know, still a pretty warm day, but nothing like crazy hot 102 or whatever when you're trying to wear a racing suit made out of kangaroo, baby, and sweating to death out there, and motorcycles breaking down and everything. So it's good circuit. We had, like I said, we had free practice 1 and 2 on Thursday and Friday, which is kind of interesting because we don't often get to talk about free practice on these Friday shows because I typically record them before free practice has actually happened. But it has happened already now as I record this, so I've got some notes. And one thing you may have noticed if you saw the results of free practice 1 and 2 is that your fastest rider in free practice 1 was Casey Stoner. So, wow, you know, where'd he come from? And get this, you're going to be even more surprised that the fastest rider in free practice 2 was Kenny Roberts Jr. Set the fastest lap time in the second free practice and also set a new circuit best lap of 156.905. And Casey Stoner also did very well in free practice 2, so he seems to be doing quite well at this track. I didn't get a chance to totally read up on everything and study every report and find the interviews with Casey and all that to sort of find out why he's, what's clicking here for him or what's he doing right. However, I understand that Kenny Roberts was using, might have been using qualifying tires because he was going out for like 3-lap stints. So that would make somewhat of a difference on his times compared to some of the other riders, but typically they'll often sub a qualifier on there anyways to get the fast lap. So I'm not trying to take away from Kenny's fast lap. That's great news, especially for Team Roberts, to have the fast time in there. And yes, I know practice is practice is practice. The times are meaningless, blah, blah, blah. But it's still very, very cool. And I thought it was kind of neat. And I actually emailed Chuck Axelin about it. And I said, hey, congratulations. And he replied that thanks, Bob. Thought I'd give you something to talk about on this week's show. So hopefully we can keep it going tomorrow, which is Friday for the second or third practice session and for qualifying. So thanks very much for your email there, Chuck. That was kind of cool. And good luck to you tomorrow and on race day there, Kenny. I'd also sent a reply to that email to Chuck, and it must have got to him a little bit too late in the day, so he didn't have a chance to reply to it yesterday, or whatever the way you want to look at it, Thursday evening for him. However, he replied to me, and I just got the email here late at night while I'm editing the show together, so I'm going to insert this into that sort of previously recorded segment. Might sound a little bit funny. I asked Chuck, can you point to any one area that might have been a big reason for Kenny Roberts Jr.'s, performance there in free practice 2? Chuck replies, not really one specific area. We had a good test the day after Jerez. The main thing is that we are learning all the time and we're getting the settings better. Our goal is to continue to improve the machine. We have a new chassis targeted for Le Mans, which tidies a lot of areas up and should be another improvement. Having a good engine and tires has allowed us to just focus on the chassis, and this has been a big help to us. We've always had confidence in Kenny Jr., so we know if he has a good bike, he can be a contender. So, great. Thank you very much for replying to that email, Chuck. I'm glad I had a chance to get it in to this show. Other stuff that happened, a lot of the other teams couldn't seem to kind of get it together on there. Kawasaki didn't have a very good time. They were having a lot of troubles finding a good setup. Suzuki had a not very good day. And even Camel Yamaha, Rossi and Edwards have said, Rossi has said that they have not found the problems. They have not solved the problems for their rear tire vibrations that they're getting and that plagued them at Jerez. They just had a miserable weekend at Jerez, and they have not yet solved the problems. However, here at Qatar, the nature of the circuit makes it a little bit less noticeable. It's somewhat less of a problem for them. So we'll have to see if they can change whatever they're going to have to change to their setup and you know, get everything together and come out on race day to win it, or what's going to happen. As far as predictions, I just don't have any. I'm in the dark here. I don't think it's going to be a runaway for Ducati or any of the Bridgestone teams, to be honest with you. This track, I think they're going to have troubles. I do look for Pedrosa to do quite well. Apparently, we're going to look for Kenny Roberts to do pretty well. That's kind of cool. And I think that Rossi will also pull off a Rossiism and come out well. And if, you know, if somebody said, you know, who's going to win it, I would go with the safe bet. Although actually I think that at the rideon2.com tipping competition, I did not put Rossi down as first. I think I put Rossi down as the place getter. And if I recall correctly, I ended up going with Pedrosa in first. His first win in MotoGP on his second race. Well, you know, it's possible. It's you know, it could happen. And he's going to have to improve his time a lot from front of free practice one, but the free practice sessions are just that. They're just practice. So we can't rely 100% on those times. I do think that judging from those times that we can look for Kenny Roberts in the top 50% and hopefully a lot better than that. I think they can actually do quite a bit better than that. That motor is just pulling for them, and they've got a good chassis and it's just the right mix. And it just goes to show you what their last year's season could have been like if they hadn't been saddled with basically a motor that never got the development that it needed. So, you know, we're looking for them to do pretty well. Like I said, Suzuki and Kawasaki being on the Bridgestones, not so sure. Suzuki, anyway. Kawasaki, you know, they might be able to do something, but Nakano didn't have a very good weekend. And the same with Ducati. The Ducatis might be able to take advantage of that front straight and do quite well. I mean, we had Caparossi on pole last year, but the tires are what killed him last year. Now, Bridgestone's made so many strides that he may do a little bit better. So we're going to hope for the best on them. And then, as usual, the Hondas, there's just so many of them, and they have the most money. So you can always look for those sprinkling of Hondas throughout the thing. You're going to see the usual faces up front, Pedrosa, Mind Landry, and Hayden. Elias will do well. Tomata has just been something of an enigma. I'm not sure why Tomata, you know, he was so promising in 2004. And his 2005 season was really nothing special at all. And so we'll just have to see how he does the rest of this year. And then Casey Stoner, who did very, very well in the first practice session as well. So we might see some of him. It's a little bit unknown. He missed so much testing because of that shoulder injury that we just, I'm not 100% sure what to expect from Stoner. But, you know, I think it's going to be a good race, and I am really looking forward to it. And don't forget that it's on Saturday this year, and that Qatar, it's also at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, local Qatar time, instead of 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which puts it at the same time in Europe, you know, the normal 2 o'clock, because Qatar is apparently an hour ahead. Whatever, there's a timer on MotoGPOD.com on the front page. You've got Steve Jones's Excel spreadsheet, which he just recently updated. So if you've been using that, you need to download his newest update. There's a link to that on the website, MotoGPOD.com, and SteveJones.cc. So you need to get a new one of those. And then, if all else fails, take a look at the official MotoGP.com website to make sure that you know when that race is going to start. So if you are watching it on the internet, you don't come in too late or too early or whatever. And you might want to get there early anyways, because often the servers are overloaded and it seems to somewhat be a sort of a first come first serve. You know, if you can get on and have the stream going well, which they had some disastrous times last race with the Jerez race, it pretty much pooped out halfway through. And I'm glad that I wasn't relying on it live to watch, because I just would have been upset. I did have some problems of my own with the MotoGP.com. We're going to talk about that in a later show. So in any event, check it out, and we'll talk about it again. We'll have a race report hopefully up on Monday, maybe Sunday night. It's a Saturday race, so I should have the race report up on Sunday night. I don't see why not, and we'll talk about it a little bit then. All right, we're going to take a lap of the LaSalle circuit in Qatar right now, where I'm going to watch the onboard video and describe what I'm seeing, tell us what gear we're in and everything. We start off on one of the longer front straightaways in the MotoGP circuits. It's going to sixth gear. Then we come into turn one, a sharp right-hander all the way down to second gear for turn one. It's almost 180 degrees turn to the right, and it's leading us onto a very, very short section of straightaway into turn two, which is a left-hander, taking us back almost, not quite, but almost another 180 degrees. We're in second gear for that. Then we move on up into third gear for turn three, a narrow, fast right-hander. And then we're going down a short chunk of straightaway. We're coming up to turn four, which is a 90-degree right-hander. We're down into second gear for turn four, which leads onto a very short section of straightaway, just enough to disrupt the corners, to another 90-degree right-hander at turn five. Then we're on another short section of straightaway, leading into the left-hander, almost 180 degrees, all the way down to first gear for turn six there. And then we have a short section of straightaway again, and we're going to go into a right turn, 180 degrees. And this one is then in second gear here. This leads on to turn eight, which is more of a sort of a sweeping left-hander, more of a straightaway, really. And then to turn nine, a second gear right-hand corner. Then into turn 10, a increasing radius left-hander that's going to take us up into the fantastic turn 11 sweeper, which is a very, very long third or fourth gear corner, all the way left, all the way up into the complex of right-handers at turns 12, 13, and 14, where we have early, not too sharp, right-handed turns in second gear right-handers separated by chunks of straightaway. And that's a challenging series of turns right there, leading on to a section of straightaway right before we get to the left-handed turn 15, down into second gear for that. And then another straightaway is quite a bit of a little bit longer one here. This is going up through the gears a tiny bit, and now we're going down through the gears hard on the brake for turn 16, a very sharp right-handed corner that leads us back onto the front straight. And we're back out on that long front straight. We're going up through the gears, third, fourth, there's fifth. Now we're up into sixth gear just in time to cross the finish line and complete our lap of LaSalle today. Okay, I have Mark Vandeman on the phone with me. Mark Vandeman is from ProMoto, the distributors of Suzuka tire warmers and the Cycle Cinch, among other products. And we're going to talk a little bit about today about tire warmers. So, Mark, how are you doing? Welcome to MotoGP OD.
Thanks for having me, Bob. I appreciate the time.
Okay, no problem. It's nice to have you aboard here. So, tire warmers might tend to be something of a bit of an overlooked feature on the grid, but they're a very, very important feature, and also something that, you know, race teams do go out of their way to get sponsorships for and everything. So I thought it was sort of germane to MotoGP OD, and maybe we can get some information about going on tire warmer. First of all, why don't we start off with, why do the teams even use tire warmers?
Well, I think the first response to that is the most common response is it helps reduce the probable causes of cold tire crashing. Everybody, I think, who has seen a race or experienced a race or been to the track understands that tires do take a few laps to come up to temperature, so it's only obvious for the race teams as to why they want to try and maximize their track time by having tires at temperature before the bikes get out onto the track.
Okay, and how quickly would a tire warmer be able to heat that up to a closer to optimum temperature?
Well, obviously, the ambient air temperature has a lot to do with it, the conditions of the day. But typically, you want to look for an hour, maybe an hour and 15 minutes. It depends on the warmer that you're using, as well as the tire compound, and what you're really looking for. If you're looking for just heat soaking the tire, where you get the carcass of the tire all the way soaked through, or are you looking to stabilize the air pressure within the tire?
Okay, so when you talk about heating the entire carcass of the tire and you're trying to get that pressure inside stabilized, and so now what kind of increase are you likely to see from a, you know, a cold tire to a hot tire as far as those internal pressures are concerned?
You can see temperatures increase anywhere from 15 to 30% from a cold setting to a hot setting. So it's very important that you try and stabilize that pressure before you go out onto the track so that you don't have a difference in the way that the bike handles three laps into a race.
Okay, and unlike a street tire where you're always encouraged to check your tire pressures cold and all that to allow for so that you're not underinflated, a racer is going to want to know what his pressure is when that tire is heated up, correct?
Correct. More and more of the trackside vendors for the tire manufacturers are starting to quote hot tire pressures for their racers versus a cold tire pressure.
Interesting. What do those tire pressures range generally, ballpark?
We've seen them anywhere from, you know, on average about 35 PSI front and rear. Obviously, the condition of the day is going to affect that. The racetrack surface is going to affect that. The compound of the tire is going to affect that. And that's why you really need to work closely with your tire vendor and then also make sure that you're utilizing your tire warmer to its fullest. Our warmers take about an hour and 15 minutes to pressure to stabilize the air pressure. The carcass heats up in about 45 or 50 minutes. It takes about another 20, 25 minutes for the air pressure to stabilize.
35 PSI, I always understood. I always thought race tires were fairly soft. That's actually, you know, a pretty high tire pressure, so that's kind of interesting. Now, aren't a lot of teams, don't they use nitrogen or some other inert gas rather than just straight air in their tires?
Yes, a lot of the upper teams will use a nitrogen fill just so that they can reduce the amount of moisture that's inside from the heating and cooling, just like, you know, condensing. And you generate a lot of water vapors when you go from a hot to a cold temperature.
Okay, now, what are some of the reasons that you don't want water vapor inside that tire? What's that going to do to affect the tire?
That will, the next time you heat that tire, it will affect your air pressure. It will also eventually work its way out.
Okay, so yeah, you've got sort of water being centrifugally forced to the outside of the tire. Okay. And that brings me to the next question of what is kind of an optimum temperature that we're looking for to get that tire warmed up to before we even go out on the track?
Typically, the tire manufacturers like to see them in the range of 170 to 180, 85 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay. So somewhat shy of 100 degrees Celsius, probably ballpark about 80 or 85 degrees Celsius, I guess. And then, okay. Now after that, the tires do get considerably hotter when typically on a typical race day, on a nice warm sort of, you know, summer day, the tires are going to get quite a bit warmer than that on the track, aren't they?
Correct. Yes. The tire will get warmer, obviously from, you know, your carcass temperatures will vary depending upon if you're in a left-hand corner, right-hand corner, front straightaway, that kind of stuff. But the average temperature will be around that, probably about 15 degrees Celsius higher than that.
Okay, so getting up there then, almost to the water boiling point. Cool. Now, we did talk already about heating the entire carcass. If you do have, say, you're pressed for time, or there's some sort of mix-up where all of a sudden you need to put intermediates on, because I assume you also use tire warmers on intermediates and even reins, correct?
Correct, yes.
So if you have to sort of fast heat this tire, is that going to still help if you just sort of heat the surface?
It does help, but that's actually when you start running the risk of breaking down the carcass of the tire. You know, tires are made of, you know, obviously silica, synthetic rubber, natural rubber. You've got oil, you know, emulsifiers, plasticizers, activators, all of these agents that kind of help make the tire grip. And when you heat those agents too quickly, it's just like cooking. You come up with a bad result. So you have to be a little more careful on how you heat your tire. And make sure that you don't do it too rapidly. So obviously the longer you have, you know, if you can allow for the hour time to heat the tire, you're better off. But if you need to quickly do it, yes, some heat is better than no heat.
Okay, and would a typical good quality tire warmer have multiple settings or a thermostat, or how do they control the temperature on that?
You have basically, you have a standard temperature or a fixed, hopefully, a tire warmer that has a thermostat in it set at a predetermined temperature by the manufacturer. Our standard warmers come at 175 degrees. Then you have you have adjustable warmers, either a digital control box or two thermostats that are preset. We offer a dual temp, a 130 for a rain slick or a standby mode, or a 175.
Okay, interesting. Now, if you do, kind of dancing around here a little bit, but I just sort of thought of this one. If you do heat that tire too quickly and you're primarily sort of heating the surface, basically what you're doing there is, are you kind of boiling off those kind of volatile chemicals out of the tire?
Not necessarily boiling off the chemicals, just not properly preparing the tire. You want to think of the tire as your first step in suspension, correct? The tire fluctuates around, and when your tire is stabilized, it helps your suspension work better so that the bike's more controllable and the tire also works optimal from a grip perspective.
Okay, interesting. And now what about the weaving that we see guys do out on the track? Perhaps maybe they've had tire warmers on, maybe they have no tire warmers. They're, you know, if they're at a club racing or lower level, pro level. Is that kind of a myth to be able to heat your tires up quickly by weaving?
I believe so, yes. I've talked to several tire manufacturers, several company employees of tire manufacturers. They all agree weaving, it doesn't put the proper heat into the tire.
Okay, interesting. So basically there's either you need tire warmers plus, you know, probably what, half a lap or so, or you need a couple laps to get those tires up to temp, right?
Yeah, usually 2 to 3 laps depending upon the rider.
And then why do we see some teams, many teams in fact, putting tire warmers on the bikes after the race? Is this something to sort of hide the tire from spying eyes so that, you know, competitions can't see any weaknesses or strengths, or is it something that does something else to the tire?
There's a lot of reasons why teams do it. One, the top teams do it obviously for trade secrets, that kind of stuff. The tire companies like to see it, especially at the MotoGP level. But from a privateer perspective, I believe personally a lot of the teams I work with utilize the tire warmers to help extend the tire life so that they can then use those tires for practices, testing, that type of stuff. Just like you want to control the heating of the tire, you also want to control the cooling of the tire. So if you can elongate the cooling process, your tire will have a longer life.
As far as the tire warmers that you distribute, the Suzuki, is there anything you want to comment on those and features and anything else?
The Suzuki tire warmer overall, for the construction of the warmer, is a lot thinner than the warmers on the marketplace currently. We use a different installation material that has the same heating characteristics. It just makes it an easier fit under the front fender through the rear swing arm. Another feature is the side walls have a single-sided pull string. So at the end of the day, you can lay the warmer flat, which makes it easier to roll up.
For storage?
Correct.
Okay, and that sort of thing. Cool. Outstanding. And then as far as pro moto and everything, what kind of involvement are you seeing in, at say, a pro level racing? Are you getting into any of these teams?
Yes, actually, we're happy to announce our sponsorship with Hot Bodies Racing this year for the 2006 AMA season.
Outstanding. So we're going to see Suzuki tire warmers and pro moto out there on the Hot Bodies team, huh?
Correct. Yeah, they have 6 sponsored riders for this year, and we'll have Suzuki tire warmers on each of their bikes.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have to look for that on the AMA grid. And, who knows, next up, the world, right?
Certainly.
You never know. Do you think that having the sponsorship with Hot Bodies is really going to affect your business as a whole? I mean, how much return do you think you'll get from a sponsorship like that?
Sponsorships are, for me, a little more like advertising, as well as credibility. If you've got a good team that utilizes your product, then it helps show that that it's worthwhile for, the privateer racer to make the investment into your brand.
Okay, interesting. And now, are you going to be going around with the team as I mean, we see a lot of, like, there'll be the technician from the certain brands in the team shop. And is this something that you're likely to be doing at any of the races of the AMA series calendar this year?
Yeah, I'll be going around to all the races, not all of the races, but definitely will be at the Barber event here in a couple of weeks, as well as many as the rest of the schedule will allow me to come.
So working with the teams in the garages and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I do have a couple of privateer racers that I've been working with over the past couple of years that I try and help out as much as I can. And then obviously having the bigger team with Hot Bodies this year is definitely a big bonus for me as well.
Well, thanks very much for being on the show today. It's been kind of fun learning about tire warmers, Mark.
No problem at all. I mean, just like a racer wants to make sure that they have the same settings on their suspension, they want to have the same settings within their tires. And to do that, preheating the tire is the best way to do that.
All right. Anybody that needs a set of tire warmers, maybe they're into racing themselves or very, very serious track days or whatever, they can find your website at cyclecinch.com. And, of course, I'll put a link to that on the MotoGPOD.com website. And good luck to you and Hot Bodies Racing in the upcoming season. And we'll talk to you soon, Mark.
Sounds great, Bob. Thank you.
That's it for today. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you very much to Komodo for all of their support and to Wayne Wilder there at Komodo in particular. I encourage you to check out the KomodoGear.com website. They have some very, very cool stuff. Also, thanks you to Chuck Axland of Team KR for answering my emails and questions and helping out in general. And Mark Vandeman of Promoto for his time on the phone. And of course, a very big thank you to you people out there, all you listeners, for making the show what it is and for all your emails and support and good wishes about the deployment and all that kind of stuff. I'm getting all kinds of comments going on about that. And as always, if you want to send me an email with comments or suggestions or corrections to mistakes or whatever it is, I am Bob Hayes, and my email address is motogpod@motogpod.com. I read all the emails. I like getting them. I reply to them. I am a little busy lately, so the replies might not be very long, but they are, you know, something. In any case, whatever. Next time, ride safe, because it is riding season. I know you're getting your motorcycles out from the long winter's nap that they've been in there. So ride safe out there and enjoy the races. We're going to have our Qatar race wrap-up on Sunday. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGPOD isn't affiliated with any of them.